All right, good morning, everybody. Good morning. Thanks for coming.
I couldn't close it, but if you can close it, yeah, that'd be great.
Welcome to the ethics panel. We're going to be talking about access. Let me introduce everybody. First, we have Judge Peter Carey on the far end there from the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Maine. Stephen Morrell from the U.S. Trustee's Office in Maine. And Marlene Sallow from next to me from the Disability Law Center with offices in Boston and Northampton. And most prestigiously, me. Thank you for laughing. Yes. Offices on the North Shore, great city of Lynn. So, thanks again for coming. We're going to be spending our time this morning focusing on a single word, and then we're going to extrapolate that. And the word is going to be access. Who has access to the bankruptcy court? Why and how? And we're going to focus on people with disabilities, people with language barriers, who are afforded bankruptcy relief just because they're in this country, but sometimes it can be difficult. And we're going to focus also on cost of bankruptcy, unbundled services, ethical considerations of all of that. So, I'd like to first turn to Marlene, which is easy because she's next to me. And can you talk a little bit about how private practitioners can comply with the law?
So good morning, everyone. I'm the non-bankruptcy attorney among you.
Lucky you.
I have very little experience with bankruptcy law, having worked in a firm in Florida. So I used to do the creditors' meetings in Florida, but that's as far as it goes. But as it applies to your clients, I can speak to that because clients are individuals, and every individual presents with their own needs, whether it's language or hearing or mobility. And one of the things that I like to do when I speak to attorneys is to raise awareness about the fact that as a law firm or a medical office, you have to comply with the ADA Title III because it's considered a public accommodation. And so then you have to ask yourself, what does that look like? And the one thing that I always stress is, as humans, when we speak to someone, we need to acknowledge the fact that whether the way that the person is presenting to you may or may not give you an idea as to whether this particular individual has intellectual or developmental disability, or whether their cognitive processing abilities might not be as sharp as yours. And so then you have to ask yourself, how do I approach each individual that walks in through my door to make sure that they understand the information that I'm providing them and that I'm allowing them to access my service and the services being provided by the court? As general practice, disabilities can be visible, but they're also invisible. And so it's really difficult for you as a practitioner to figure out if the person may need information broken down into chunks in order to allow them to understand what's being provided to them and process it. It may be difficult for you to understand as you're doing possibly an initial call that they're blind. And so one of the things that I always suggest is basic information on your website that would look like, please feel free to let us know if you require accommodations or an interpreter, because that opens the window for them to self-identify, because that's the key. Some individuals may have disabilities that they choose not to share with you. And so when you're having an interaction with them, you may ask yourself, are they really getting it? like, are they processing the information? But not everyone wants to acknowledge that they have a disability. But if from the beginning you let each and every individual that you have contact with understand that if they need an interpreter, please let you know. If they require an accommodation, please let you know. Then that gives them the green light to self-identify. As an employer myself at a disability law center, when I hire individuals, I can't flat out ask them, do you have a disability? But we always ask, if you require any accommodations, even on the job post, please let us know, because that gives them the green light to self-identify. So what does it look like when you're having conversations with your clients? Well, the first thing is always ask them, like, pause and say, you know, what I just shared with you, do you need me to go over it? Did you understand it? If they haven't self-identified. But if they do self-identify, then you need to ask them, what works best for you? So, for instance, someone may have an intellectual disability. Let's break it down. Maybe someone has a learning disability where it's an auditory processing disability. So if it's auditory processing, you can speak to them all you want, but it's going to be difficult for them to process the information accurately and at the speed that you're offering it. And so in that situation, it's easier to provide the information in writing, because then it's a visual processing that comes into play, and they can take their time in reading the material and asking the required questions. At the end of the day, what the client needs is what dictates how you're going to approach the delivery of the information. If your client is deaf or hard of hearing, then you have to ask them, what is it that you need? Do you need an interpreter? And if the individual requests an interpreter, then it's up to you to pay for that interpreter. It's up to you to get that interpreter in the office to allow you to have communications with your client that are comprehensive in nature and that allows you to share information and allows the client to then ask the necessary questions.
Marlene, can I ask a stupid question coming from somebody that
never
is
stupid.
Not in private practice anymore? So let's say that I took a volunteer lawyer, through the Volunteer Lawyers Project, a non-paying client, and then a client shows up at my office and said, oh, by the way, you must hire an interpreter so that you can represent me.
And what, you have to.
You have to do that.
Yeah, because you're offering that service, and you're considered public accommodation. And so if I'm providing you legal services, and I have to make sure that the legal services are accessible.
And the test isn't that I'm not getting paid. The test is what the financial impact is on my business?
Correct. And whether it's an undue burden in providing an interpreter, if you take the totality of your business, may be nominal in nature and wouldn't rise to the level of an undue burden. Yes, ma'am.
Would that same requirement exist if it's the initial meeting with the client before you agree to take on representation?
So the question,
we got to repeat the question.
Go ahead.
The question was, would that same requirement exist if this is an initial conference before you've decided to take on the client?
And that's why it's always important. It's, for me, it's a best practice that even when you're doing the initial meeting, I was in private practice many moons ago, to ask, do you require an interpreter? Do you need any accommodations? Because then you can set it up accordingly, and it's not a waste of time for the client, and it's not a waste of time for you. And then there's a caveat to that. If they need, for instance, an ASL interpreter or even a language interpreter, you need to give yourself some time to be able to secure one. Especially with ASL interpreters, it could take up to 4 weeks to be able to schedule an appointment. Yes, sir.
So can you rely on a relative of the person, or...
Do you want So the question is, can you rely on a relative? And I would say no. It's frowned upon because information can be missed. Myself, Spanish is my first language, and I served as an interpreter for my grandmother when she used to go to the doctor's offices, and I was 8 years old. Not exactly the best thing to do, but that's how they worked it. But the common practices, even myself with the Disability Law Center, where we have individuals that speak multiple languages, we always have an interpreter because you want to be able to not miss any information because you want it to be done in real time.
And does that interpreter sign something that says, they're truthfully interpreting, or like, how do you know the interpreter is interpreting?
So the question is, does the interpreter sign something so that you know it's truthful? Get a certified interpreter. That's the best bet. Yes.
What does ASL stand for?
Oh, American Sign Language, which is commonly used in the U.S. and Canada, so North America. So that's the deaf and hard of hearing and the visual, but then there are also physical disabilities, and sometimes you may have someone that will come into your office that uses a cane or has a walker or is in a wheelchair. So first things first. Do you have is your front door accessible? In other words, is it wide enough to allow the wheelchair to come through? Do you have a clearance in the front of your office, if your office has a front area, where they can turn their wheelchair around as necessary, right? Are your tables too high up or too low for someone in a wheelchair? When they're in a walker, they're using a cane, you should always ask, would you like assistance? Not, do you need assistance? So those are the little key words, because then you're implying, if you say, do you need assistance, that they can't handle it on their own. So the question is, do you want assistance? I, myself, recently asked someone if they wanted my help. And they were not happy with me. So we can all make mistakes. We're human. And so when you don't know how to handle something or how to best approach a situation, you just ask. So do you need assistance? Do you want assistance? And if so, how can I help you? If someone has problems with their gait, or even someone that's blind, you know, we have the tendency of kind of reaching out and trying to help physically, but don't do that. Just ask, do you want to hold my elbow? May I hold the door open for you? So let them tell you what it is they need. The same with the visually impaired, you know, they will speak to you directly because they go where the sound is. Speak to them directly. Don't look at the interpreter if they have an interpreter. Always speak directly to the individual, whether they're blind or visually impaired. That is important. Acknowledge and humanize the person, and don't focus on their disability. So those are just some of the tips that I would offer. And as folks speak here today, I may jump in and say, well, with a person with a disability, you may want to approach this differently. But just keep in mind that the different areas where you can facilitate, where you can increase accessibility and make sure accommodations are being provided is that initial phone call, your website. Some people who are blind or visually impaired will use a reader. So that brings a whole new realm to everything, because is your website itself accessible, where someone who uses a reader can go on your website and that reader will read everything that's on your website? Have that language that says, if you require accommodations or an interpreter, please let us know. Remember, when you have, you know, I've heard that some firms will have lots of documents for an initial client to review. The person may need assistance in reviewing the documents. The person may need you to break it down for them. I just had an individual come to my office who upfront said, these are all my disabilities, and I can't have you interrupt me while I'm speaking to you, because then I'll forget what I'm saying. It was a two-hour intake where I sat there and I just kept quiet and just documented everything until the gentleman was able to lay it all out for me, before I could then start the interaction. And I know that that's difficult, right? Because especially when you're in private practice, time is money. But that's an extreme example of what an accommodation looks like. So remember about your documents. Remember how you speak to them, and sometimes you may be required to chunk information up. And then when it ultimately comes to going to court, so technically speaking, the bankruptcy court doesn't have to abide by the ADA.
Can I just put a note on that?
Yeah.
I didn't realize till this morning that the federal courts are not governed by the ADA.
We just assumed it was, so don't worry about it.
There you go.
And so, but what I thought, what was interesting is that judicial conference policy has said we'll do it anyways, even though we don't have to do it.
Right.
So I find it interesting, and I don't know, Judge Katz or Judge Finkel, you know, what your various courts do, but I know that we are not in a federal courthouse or a federal building. We're in rented space above a head shop and a bagel shop. I know that there are things that we that I'm aware of as a judge, and I thought that one of the points that you were taking that was so interesting is the translator piece. And so
I just want to say I just applied to the Federal Bar Admission Fund. I asked the district court if I could have funds to link up with a company that provides on an ad-needed basis interpreter services over the phone.
Good.
So it's not a huge cost. Mm-hmm. Any language. So if somebody walks into court and they're not able to speak English and they have their, you know, granddaughter with them, we can now hook up with this company, or we'll be able to shortly, and then get the interpreter on the phone. And so the Bar Association funds are available for that as long as your district court approves it. And it's so it doesn't happen all that often. I did have one before. I said, you got to get an interpreter. It's like 3 or 4 years ago. But then I became aware of this program. Susan, my clerk, knows how to do it. It's really a good sort of way to use funds. And it's promoting access to justice. So most district courts will allow it. So this is a new thing for us.
That's great.
This is my opportunity to put in a plug for the United States Trustee Program. I assume that you folks know that there are interpretive services available in the 341 meeting rooms across the nation.
But not for court.
But not for court. That's right.
I'm not in the 341 room. Mm-hmm. The person's in court. They're pro se. That's what I need.
But in terms of accommodations with the debtor's interface for the first time with the bankruptcy, the official bankruptcy system, all you really need to do as counsel for a debtor is to contact the trustee ahead of time, and arrangements will be made. And I believe it's a very comprehensive service in the sense that there are like 150 languages that can be accessed just by a telephone call.
But you know what? That's not their first interaction. Their first interaction is in the clerk's office. Mm-hmm. They come in and they want the paperwork and they want to know how do they fill it out. So I think we can hook up on this phone service even for that.
That's great. That's terrific.
And for the other times, just to jump in. Oh, sorry, did you have a question?
No, I was just going to say, I'm the chapter 7 trustee, and the service that Steve's talking about is wonderful. And I think that for common languages like French and Spanish, you can just call in without even planning to do it. Other less common languages, you actually have to book an appointment because they need to make sure that they have an appropriate interpreter available. The other thing that I would say is that for Ms. Sello, in my mind, a lot of what you're saying, particularly for practitioners who don't do it every day like you do, seems really intimidating. And yet, I think it's not necessarily that intimidating. I've handled like unemployment, volunteer unemployment cases in Maine. They come in through VLP, volunteer lawyer, private name. They do the vetting of people. They tell us when someone needs an interpreter, and they, in fact, carry the burden of setting up the interpreter.
That's great.
The interpreter. Mm-hmm. So that when I've had, I think, one or two clients private interpreters, and they set up the meeting, and we've arranged the interpreter, we're paying for it. And then you make sure the interpreter's appearing. So there are resources out there.
Yes.
And in my mind, the notion of someone walking through the door and then you suddenly be obligated to hire an interpreter is a lot more intimidating than what it really is in practice, because I think in a lot of situations, the way you get these clients that you have needs are through resources that are out there that make sure they have interpreters in person.
Yes, and the documents that I submitted, there's actually resources for each state that's participating in today's conference where you can reach out to those agencies and they can guide you as to which services you can hire and who's available within each particular state. So I would ask you to take a look at those and become familiar with what's available in your state.
I was going to give a plug for Marlene's materials, exactly that, and to say also in the materials is a court-by-court listing of what each court has available, so that those are in the materials also.
I would also just let everybody know that the commission, the Consumer Commission's report recommends that 28 U.S.C. 1827D should allow bankruptcy courts to provide transaction services to all parties, and they can be done telephonically, and that the courts would use appropriated funds for the translation services, which means that debtors won't have to pay for them. And then also we recommend the judiciary should commission the translation of bankruptcy forms.
Oh, yes, that's very important.
There's some problems with that because the boxes don't all line up, but I mean, this is something that we aspire to, and these recommendations are being made to the appropriate rules committee and so forth.
Thank you.
And also just from the private practice perspective, me and my office, again, on the North Shore, there's a lot of buildings, including mine, that's, you want to talk about handicap accessible. It's like, you know, those buildings that's it's like a Victorian home with, you know, Salmon P. Chase, 1777 up front. The stairs are like, you know, very high. But it's not that bad because when VLP sends me a case, if there's issues, I just go to VLP and do the consult there.
Oh.
And it's not even an issue. It probably happened once.
And if there are rare cases where you will not have an interpreter because it's a dialect of Italian that no one but the family speaks, or some kind of Chinese that there isn't. So you will run into it occasionally and have to let the family member.
Right. Having practiced in Central Florida, we had migrant workers there. And, you know, I got called into the courtroom by a judge to serve as an interpreter because he figured from Central America you speak Spanish, but it was a dialect that I had no clue. And so you just have to use whatever is available there in order to lay the foundation for next steps and then try to find someone. There have been occasions, I used to do nationwide court observations where there may be parts of the country where there's nobody available for that particular dialect, and you just do the best that you can. But that's the most important thing. And I think the last thing that I'll say, which I believe is very important that we all should be aware of, is always use person first. Don't say this person is handicapped. Don't use the R word. That is extremely offensive. When I used to teach many moons ago, I taught special ed. It was profoundly mentally handicapped, trainable mentally handicapped, We don't use those terms anymore. It is now intellectual and developmental disabilities, or someone is on the autism spectrum. But don't say this person has a mental illness, because some individuals who have psychiatric difficulties, will not take kindly to you saying they have a mental illness. So we need to be respectful of that as well. So it's a person with a disability. So I would just leave you with that.
So aren't we talking about this for a lot of reasons? The most selfish reason is we don't want to get sued. The much more altruistic reason is we want to do the right thing. But we also have the concern about informed consent. We have the concern about access. And so, Steve, did you have...
I think that, I guess the first question is, what does this got to do with professional ethics? And I think the answer is everything, because when we start talking about the costs and management of fees, unbundling services, bifurcating fees, what we're talking about an interaction between a lawyer and a client or a potential client that has to be managed by the conveyance of information to the client, and then in turn, as the client makes their objectives known, the attorney being appropriately responsive to the client's directions and achieving the client's objectives. That is the secret, if you will, if there is a secret, that is the secret to managing your fees in a way that will pass ethical muster. The rules of professional conduct that I'm referring to begin with Rule 1.1, which simply says that a lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. Rule 1.2 that talks about the lawyer's responsibility to abide by a client's decisions concerning the objectives of the representation and to consult with the client as to the means by which those objectives will be pursued. The rule goes on to say that it is permissible to limit the representation, but those limits are conditioned upon a couple of things. One, the limits have to be reasonable under the circumstances, and they have to be, those limits have to be negotiated with the client's informed consent. So if you step back for a moment and perhaps away from what you're imagining, which is whatever the average profile of a client might be, you know, if you represent banks, you've got professionals that you're consulting with and arranging for a fee agreement. On the other hand, it could be a non-English speaker. It could be somebody that has an intellectual disability or some sort of a impairment or a challenge. And those things are very much come into play and have to be front and center in the management of all dealings with the clients. But as we talk about access and cost, we're talking about what kind of alternative approaches there might be to the traditional debtor's counsel representation of a debtor where the attorney receives a earned upon receipt retainer. So we'll talk about those a little more specifically, but I think that the transition and the relevance of what Marlene has shared with us really sort of heightens just exactly what's involved when we talk about consulting with the client and obtaining their informed consent before proceeding.
And I struggle as a judge if I think that somebody is not understanding either the question that's being asked, either for language or some type of disability, I struggle with what my role is and how to keep away from being, taking on the role of a lawyer and jumping in. And it's hard because I've had pro se instances where I'm not a doctor, but I'm positive this person is severely challenged, has no idea of the implications of what is happening. And I have no idea what my obligations are, and I just keep pushing it into a due process category is how I've dealt with it, is to just make sure that I feel that that person is able to express whatever they want to express. But there are great concerns, and I, as a judge, I don't know how the other judges here have dealt with that, but it is truly a struggle.
Most difficult is the person who's before you obviously has some mental illness issues, does not and will not accept that they do. They're for you, and I have to kind of rein them in terms of focusing on the issues because they raise everything that's not before you. Trying to create a record for them.
Right.
Very difficult. And you just have to have patience, I think.
Yeah, I think the same as what you just mentioned, Judge Carey, which is that I let them be heard. I give them their due process. I know there have been times when I have asked, do you happen to have a friend or a family member that might be able to come to our next hearing? I always encourage them to seek counsel, but oftentimes they just don't have the financial ability to hire counsel. So.
Right.
That's another accessibility issue, inability to hire counsel. I just want to say one last thing.
Know,
I'm sorry. Yes.
It's not always. A lot of times it's, I'm right, I don't need counsel. We have a volunteer lawyer program. We have clinics. They don't take advantage of it. Many of them do not because they believe in their cause, and the law must be on their side. So it's like a blind side. You can say
we get that also in our office. The one thing that I will say is that if someone is before you with an intellectual developmental disability and they're filing for bankruptcy, I would take a step back and ask yourself why this may be happening, because sometimes we do have individuals with IDD that are under guardianship.
What did you say, IDD?
Oh, intellectual and developmental disability. I apologize for the acronym. that are under guardianship or that have assigned a representative payee from the Social Security office, and that representative payee is charged with making sure that their bills are paid and that they have money that when they need it. And if so, if they have a rep payee and there's a bankruptcy issue there, then your state's protection and advocacy agency, I happen to be the PNA for Massachusetts, needs to be aware, because we investigate violations of rep payee agreements on behalf of the Social Security office. So that's just a put that little idea in your head. If they have a intellectual developmental disabilities, and anywhere in that document it says they have a rep payee, question that, and that may be a red flag in and of itself that someone may be using their money inappropriately.
We had a case in Boston with Judge Bailey where a woman was pro se who clearly had some sort of intellectual disability, and she was fighting against a foreclosure of her condominium. And Judge Bailey actually appointed an attorney on her behalf. He contacted one of our local attorneys who stepped in and acted sort of as a guardian for her in the case. He was ultimately able to get paid out of the sale of the condominium, but that worked really well.
I got an instance where I do not believe it was an intellectual disability, but somebody lost their attorney for whatever reason, and I got very concerned about this person incriminating themselves, and actually was worried enough to use CJA, Criminal Justice Act, funds to get a public defender appointed. Some of you have seen know about the case, so I'm not going to talk too much about it, but I think it was the first time it was done, and I considered it an access to justice or a prevention from inadvertent injustice. But anyway, it's just a thought out there. Let's see if we can all blow apart the CJA funding by getting...
And just to follow up on that, that particular case was really effective. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was like the other important thing is sort of continuity of information gathering. I mean, if these issues come up, as trustee, I've had instances where a debtor signs a petition, and then they show up at the 341 with someone who's their legal guardian, who is purporting to sort of test it. So they're like, oh, they're testifying, like, and then you have all these questions, like, where did the information come from, and how reliable is the petition? And so if you know as counsel that the legal guardian is the person who's going to be testifying in the 341, then they should probably also be the person who signed the petition. Otherwise, it just creates problems. And it really sort of draws into question the quality of the accuracy of the information, the schedules, and the quality of the information provided there.
And back to Steve's point, it calls into question informed consent. And we see that in languages, right? If you have a... we see that in language cases, a fair bit.
I was wondering, in terms of guardianship, is it more appropriate that the probate court appoint a conservator than using the bankruptcy process? Or?
Well, sure, but... I think that's probably for you guys, but... that time and cost, though, can take months. Pending foreclosure sometimes has to be done at the last second. But I know, and the site is escaping me, it's a New Hampshire case. As far as appointing a next friend to file on behalf of someone who's in, I'm using this word because it's in the code, incompetent. It's not my word, but it's in the code, incompetent debtor. It's Judge DC, that's who it is, laid out the procedures for that. And you would like to have, and I can't remember which one it is, guardian or conservator, I think is the right one. But sometimes it's just not possible. So, do we, any questions? Any more questions about access to justice from that angle? Yes, Don.
Are there questions you ask? Are there cues that you can pick up from a client so you know
I think the being able to spot the cues comes from experience more so. But if you're asking, if you're relaying information, and you're getting the feeling that they're not following what you're saying or they're not keeping up, then I would just stop and just say, did you understand what I just shared with you? Can you repeat it back to me to make sure that we're on the same page? And if they're unable to repeat it back to you, then you can ask, do you need me to slow down? Would it be easier for me to just give you small pieces at a time, just to have them, you know, it all goes to informed consent. If they're not following what you're saying, and if they don't understand what the outcomes are, then is it true informed consent? I view it like juveniles, right? When they get picked up by officers and, you know, Mirandized, and sometimes our juveniles need things broken down a bit more for them in order for them to comprehend. And so that should be easy to do across the board is the way I view it.
With three juveniles at home, I can attest to that.
it's just, not everyone's going to pick up on social cues, right? That's just, it's just the way it is. Some of us are a little bit more experienced in doing that. Some of us just pick up on it. Other people don't. And so it's just always taking just the time to treat the individual that you're working with as you would want to be treated, and just making sure that they understand. Sometimes we're so busy just trying to get it done that we don't take the time to actually make sure that folks understand where we're coming from. Yes, ma'am?
Well, in Boston, I've noticed that there is a GAL.
Right. That's new, yeah.
Did you say a garden ad litem?
Taking from the probate court the idea of, and I've had Judge Bailey prior to that get the feeling that the guardian was not protecting the ward.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the word.
And so he and I happened to be sitting in the courtroom, mm-hmm. and Judge Bailey said, "Elaine, will you come here, please?" And I appointed me as a guardian ad litem to do investigation and come back to the court. Mm.
What statutory provision did the judge do?
I don't think
it's rule.
105. Yeah, did someone say 105?
Catch on.
In this code.
Yeah. What's that?
In the federal rule.
1016.
So rule 1016, yeah. And so in Massachusetts, we now have asked people to volunteer. And the judges, we all have a list of people that we could call if we needed to. In my mind, it's mostly pro se because the attorneys have usually figured it out ahead of time, and they have somebody as a power of attorney who's already involved. But it certainly could happen where debtor deteriorates post-petition.
Mm, yeah.
So
right.
Things are fine, and then all of a sudden the lawyer is like, I don't know what to do, Judge. And so I have the ability to appoint someone like you, Elaine. And there is, I think we, Jacob, you might remember this from the pro bono committee, I think we have some guidance that let people know we can't promise you that you get paid. But
that is actually how it's laid out.
However, there has been a situation. I know Judge Bean had a situation where the person actually was sold some property that was exempt, and the lawyer did get paid. So sometimes there are actually assets, and so thank you for volunteering to volunteer. But hopefully, there is an ability to get paid if you do become a party in that way.
So that's fantastic questions. Thanks so much, and great materials. However, we've got a little bit of a timing issue, so I want to talk about costs. That's okay with you guys. Sort of the second part of our presentation. So we all know that costs can be an obstacle to bankruptcy relief. It's expensive to file bankruptcy. It just is. 310 for a Chapter 13, 335 for a 7. I can't afford the 11 fee, so I won't even go there. That was a joke. I'm sorry. I I just want to, just before, I'm going to go to the judge in a second, but just something I found, I'm on the consumer bar, is a peer of mine took a pro bono case, but then the IFV waiver was rejected. And so the attorney was stuck with the $300 to pay, which is not why we do pro bono. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, you want to do it for, obviously you do it for altruistic reasons. You want to help people, but you don't want to pay your filing fee out of your own pocket. So, and I'm not sure we didn't even cover this. So I'm springing on this everyone at the last moment, but I always require at least them to give me a check for that much. And I put an IALTA, if the fee waiver is granted, I give it back to them, which covers like 95% of instances. I just thought that one was interesting. I was like, that's not right. But
is
that's why you look at
it. One of those, is the judge in the room?
I'm not gonna say that. yes, ma'am.
File again, but it's usually because the information is not complete. So if it's a pro bono, usually agent will say you need to tell me A, B, C, D. But if it doesn't meet all the statutes or there's money in the bank, we're looking at a trustee who's getting $60 for the case. And they will have time. So.
Are you talking about
the fee? Yeah.
The trustee still has to administer the case and get nothing. So it's going to be the agency fitting the statutes. Yeah. Okay. But sometimes it's just a lack of enough information. The application is not really enough. And I've had that where I denied it and then I get a second chance to supplement the application and then I don't get anything. So it's a response, which I said, oh, I didn't understand that, and I
didn't look into the facts, but that is definitely possible. What happened in the one case, and that's definitely not the majority. I probably shouldn't even have mentioned it. But thank you.
Missed something or didn't have enough information, and if you follow through, I have several times granted when I first denied,
and I always think I especially look to see whether the counsel is pro bono. Mm-hmm. That helps me make my decision.
Right. Court of equity, after all. Yes.
It's related to that. What I've seen is where an attorney receives funds but then asks for a fee waiver for the filing, and those have been granted. And I was just wondering as to the thoughts from the bench and perhaps the trustee's office on that situation.
You mean why it happens?
Yeah.
Well, maybe not why.
What's that?
Yeah, what do you see from that?
Can you repeat the question?
Sorry. When an attorney is paid for his or her work, but the filing fee is waived.
When the attorney is paid for the work, but the filing fee is waived, the questioner wants to know why that happens.
And I think the case law says we're not supposed to look at the fact that there's counsel who's been paid.
It's the 150%. That's the only one that matters, right? The poverty, I think.
So.
No. Look, somebody could have $200 and $300 in the bank, but they're so negative, it's going to get used up in 3 months.
Right.
So, I'm sorry, Judge Finkel.
We're not. My case laws are not supposed to look at the fact that they paid an attorney as human beings, do we?
So let me give you an inside scoop in Maine for all of you who care about what happens in Maine. The case administrators are instructed, at least for the applications for fee waivers that I deal with, to use the poverty guidelines, 150% of DHHS poverty guidelines, and they take the following actions. If the debtor's monthly income is less than the poverty guidelines, they docket an order granting an application. I don't even see it. This gets done. If the debtor's monthly income is greater than the poverty guidelines by more than 250, and there's no explanation, they docket an order that I don't even see, denying the application. So there's that magic 250. If the debtor's monthly income is greater than the poverty guidelines by more than 250, but there's an explanation why they can't do it, it gets forwarded to Chambers. If the debtor's monthly income is greater than the poverty guidelines then by less than 250 and no explanation, it gets sent to Chambers. So that's what I look to. And so there's this 250 sort of floating thing. And for the applications to get before me,
as both Judge Finkel and Judge Katz have said, you know, if there's an explanation of why I have these medical expenses, I have this coming, this was a lump sum pay that I had this last month, but it's not going to be coming in the future, you know, that's going to get granted probably. The one thing that I instituted when I became a judge, though, is that if the case is later converted to a 13, or if there are assets that are later discovered, I want to grab back that fee and get it into the system so that the whole system is able to stay.
So what do you do to an order show cause why the granting of that order should not be vacated?
So what'll happen is that I think I have it included in my form order initially granting the fee waiver. And then if there's a conversion to a 13, if there's a requirement, and if there's one of the trustees files a notice of assets, then our clerks are triggered to look back at that issue.
Where there's a notice of assets, who pays the filing fee? Because it may be assets that are not available to the debtor if they discover some assets. So who pays that filing fee?
That's interesting. And I think, Tony, haven't we had this issue?
It's happening right now-ish.
Is it in front of me? So why don't I give an opinion on it? No.
I'll tell you right now what I think.
Tell you what I'm going to do. No.
Yeah, but the code says how you distribute funds that come into the estate. So how is a filing fee? Is it an administrative cost that has to be paid?
Yeah. I'm not commenting, but I think so. But I'm not sure. Tony, we had this in a case.
Yeah, there's been different ways it's been handled, but
Oh, great. Another criticism of my ability to do things 10 different ways.
Yeah, I'm supposed to have court, you know, whatever. So I will pay the assets that I recover unless the debtor does it. Most of the time it's a small amount, so
We're going to stick with that whatever standard. I like that.
I don't have a good answer. So there's a good question. You know, right. We've been focusing on debtors the whole time, but because Mr. Hochman only represents the white-hatted creditors, he's bringing up the point that the poor banks sometimes are getting hurt in this because these assets are disappearing.
How could that be?
No, the trustee.
Trustee, okay.
But does the code say that the claim that gets paid before talks about administrative expenses?
But is it that?
Yeah. Are you concerned that it's a deferred filing fee for an adversary proceeding or something similar?
Or deferred filing fee for the case?
For the filing fee for the case?
Yeah, I've never come across that.
Yeah. Being paid later.
Right.
That's a question. You can either order staying in.
Question?
Or order staying in.
I have single mothers, a good amount of clients for whom the filing fee is very, be like a third of what I'm charging.
Sure.
And I really wasn't aware of the court's willingness to do fee waivers. If you can give just some general guidance for us who really haven't focused on the issue of when it's available, when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate, I could just see this being a tremendous tool. When I have single mothers, people who I really...
Do you want to... No.
Okay.
No.
So yes. So what I would say is take a look at the Guide to Judiciary Policy. It's in the materials.
Okay.
But the Guide to Judiciary Policies, Volume 4, Chapter 8, Section 820. Okay? And in there, you'll find a lot of guidance on filing fee waiver applications with the initiation of a Chapter 7 case. And not only that, but on every court website, you'll also find a form, I think it's Form 3B, I'm not positive, but you'll also find the guidance in the judiciary policy.
Just in terms of assessing when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate.
It's measured by income, right?
Yeah.
50% of the poverty factor. But the other thing you look at is the expenses. Did we have recreational expenses? Or we've got tremendous transportation expenses, but we're not working. So if you have one of those situations, you need to tell me it's because we're going to the doctor every day or something, or dialysis or something. Just why, if we don't have a car and we're not working, why do we have such high expenses? So these are the things that you as a practitioner have to look at and say, this just eyeballing it looks a little weird. I need to give, or it looks excessive. I need to give an answer for further explanation.
Done.
I think within the last 3 or 4 months,
was an article on fee waivers in the ABI Journal. So, take a look.
Oh, good.
But I also think I heard that the sort of what I'm hearing is that the 150% is sort of the starting point. And the application itself is like 10 pages. So there's many places to extrapolate on the facts. And
I was just aware of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it was weird that it was here, but I assumed it was. That's what we looked
for. Almost mechanical.
Yeah. So can we, well, let's bring more questions.
So one issue that I've run into, I think a couple times, where a debtor will file a fee waiver, it gets denied, and they put them on a payment plan.
Right.
And then for whatever reason, they're pro se, or they think they're not going the way they think it was, they decide not to pay the installment payment. And there are, looks like there are assets, and that's why I'm interested. Mm-hmm. And the case gets dismissed. I have one right now, not in front of you, Judge, but so what I've done in the past is had to pay for it from assets that I may have in the estate.
You pay the filing fee?
Well, possibly from assets of the estate, possibly just to keep the case open. So
right.
That I can,
so you can grab the ass.
Yeah.
Grab is a hard word.
So
I'm sorry.
My policy on that is I do an order to show cause for the debtor as to why the case should be dismissed for failing to pay their installment fee for exactly that reason, so that the Chapter 7 trustee can say, hey, hold on. I got assets to them. So that's what I do.
And so therefore, somebody's not using the failure to pay the filing fee to get out of a 7 that they otherwise couldn't get out of.
Well, and the one that I have, it was just dismissed by, I assume, by the clerk's office.
Right.
It happened automatically.
No, there's a notice that goes out to the debtor. So the trustee, if you're looking at the docket, you get a notice
like that
we're going to do this. And so I think I've had once where a trustee has filed something, please don't dismiss. We get an email blast, right?
Yes.
So there is an order to show cause process, and you will get notice of that.
Yeah, fix that and make
it. Yeah. We're on it.
It's like a play on the. Sorry.
You said you always get the money in your IOLTA account.
Yes.
If money's tight, and if I were to start doing this, mm-hmm. I mean, I would want to be able to follow the case once they come up with whatever they agree to. Is there's counsel, if they don't pay the fees, is there an expectation that there's counsel should make up for the fees if they don't pay it, or they don't pay the case gets what's the burden on there's the fees not paid, if it's denied, what's the implication for there's counsel?
I don't really know, but I'll tell you, I think zero.
Okay.
I don't know that, but...
Well, if the case gets dismissed, then they don't get the discharge.
Right.
Are you...
Exactly.
Carol?
Yep.
Yeah.
As debtor's counsel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why Jacob was saying he ponies it up.
Right.
I think you just have to give debtors notice as debtor's counsel what could happen if you don't do it. I would never take a file for people.
I'll just say I file a lot of filing fee waivers, and I always very, very clearly explain what their responsibilities are if it gets denied. And it doesn't usually get denied, and I know that that's a chance, and they're prepared to pay. I've never had to pay one.
If it's denied, it's an automatic installment.
Yes.
So it's not like they're coming up with the money.
Yeah, they have to pay. It depends on where you are in the case, though. So if denial comes in month in, you have to pay 112 plus 75.
And what specific kind of thing is that?
Sorry.
It depends on the judge. Like sometimes I get it a week later, sometimes it's a couple weeks later.
So what percentage gets filed?
Very high percentage, but that's because I only...
Isn't it like $80 every 2 weeks or something? Is the... 75.
Yeah, it's in 4 installments, right? Isn't that the automatic order of 4 installments?
It's 112, 75, 74.
Do you want to talk about petition affairs for a minute? Or not?
Talk about what? talk about what?
Petition preparers.
Oh, yeah, I love those.
I just noticed that some courts list them. the name, the to who to avoid. I was talking before that. Well, hold on, let me finish. I was talking with Steve a few minutes ago, and he's like, "Well, isn't that like a defamation?" And I was like, "That's right." But then I looked at the court's website again, and it was just the petition prayers that have been sanctioned. So that's okay because it's factual. But not. I know Massachusetts doesn't list anybody. Yeah, but what do you think, Judge? I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
So it's the question about. Is about non-attorney petition preparers. And I have had zero experience with them. I don't know if the Debtors Council or Creditors Council in Maine are seeing them. But Judge Haynes had a rash of them, which Steve can probably speak to better than I can. But in 1997 and 1998, there was a series of, I don't know, I think what happened was the petition preparers were moving into Maine to test it out as a market. And given that Maine is not a good market for just about anything, which my wife as the economic development would kill me, but it's a tough market.
That's on the record, by the way.
I know. Maine is a tough market because we're trying to keep people from not moving there. But there four opinions. There's consolidated memorandum regarding bankruptcy petition preparers at 1997 Westlaw 615 657. Judge Haynes took this thing. It's a non-reported. It's not in the official reporter memorandum about petition preparers. I've never seen anything like it. It wasn't in one particular case. It was this memorandum. I don't even think it had an order impact. Then there are three reported cases: Hobbs 213 BR 210, Moore 232 BR 1, and Ireland 229 BR 4. These were all in the 1997-1998 period, where not surprisingly, Judge Haynes dug deeply into the three flawed petition preparers here who violated, in the code section that you'd look to is 110F.
110.
Yeah. And so I don't know if you were, were you in private practice at that time, or were you
at
USTs?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And I do remember Judge Haynes kind of declaring war on BPPs. Currently, it doesn't seem to me from where I sit that there's a high volume of BPPs.
I think it's been a big drop off for two reasons. The U.S. trustee crackdown on them. And the internet, we don't need a petition prepared. We can get a lot more on the internet.
Yeah. That's exactly right. It is. They are out there, but it's almost impossible to enforce any kind of a discipline or constraint on internet BPPs because they simply cannot be served unless there's a full-blown investigation and somehow somebody actually associates an internet BPP with an actual person in a physical location. And to some extent, it's just sort of a whack-a-mole operation.
Yeah.
But currently, anyway, it seems as though the word is out that there are rules under 110 with respect to BPPs, and it doesn't seem to be a contagion of that kind of activity that's apparent to my office, anyway. Occasionally we do have people who will sit down with debtors at the kitchen table and charge them a reasonable fee for the Scrivener effort. But more often than not, we've found that even those folks are inadvertently practicing law without a license. And in the past, we've brought those issues to the BPP's attention. We've had a pretty good history with those folks and explaining why it is that we're concerned and what the rules are. And I think, anyway, that the word is out and people are generally inclined towards compliance with them.
The bigger, the ghostwriter attorney, I get it. Pro se in court. Oh, where did you get it? My lawyer.
Right.
My lawyer did it for me.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say that. Is there more questions?
I was going to say, in a similar vein, is the UPSALT program still going on? Do you guys remember this?
I believe that there's at least one practitioner, maybe two, that are taking UPSALT cases. Of course, there has to be, for those who are not familiar, it's really sort of an internet bankruptcy in a box type situation where a debtor accesses software that enables them to file a petition. But before they file, they're given a list of practitioners who will not represent you, but they will read the petition and the schedules, and just sort of give I don't even want to call it a blessing because I don't think it's intended to be a blessing. The concept is that's really not an engagement for legal services. I think that's debatable, but that's the fundamental concept, is that lawyers are just on a volunteer basis agreeing to look at the four corners of the schedules, and then the debtor goes to the court to file a case and appears at the 341 meeting without counsel. There's a notification of legal assistance, I think it's called, that the attorney who participates in the program signs, but they are not, they don't enter an appearance and not considered to be the lawyer for the debtor. And I think where it hasn't been an overwhelming success in Maine is that lawyers, to their credit, have been very concerned about the notion that somebody comes in with a document that they intend to file in court, that they're looking for some sort of a sign-off on the part of the lawyer, and then the lawyer doesn't have any further responsibility. I think they take the fact that they probably do have some responsibility under the ethics rules, and so there's been a reluctance for a lot of attorneys to participate in the program.
Yeah, just to continue on that, the Volunteer Lawyers Project in Maine had tried to implement that
right.
With the hope that it would expand access to folks and make the attorney's job a little bit easier. But the resounding the thought from the private bar was that it actually made our job much more difficult. And so VLP has actually stopped using that program going forward.
And also the practice is throw the lawyer under the bus, it's the pro se.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's a question here. There's a question here. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I've dealt with UPSALT in a different capacity. I'm a chair of a pro bono committee that granted funds. UPSALT has changed its model. It originally was where it would pair with legal services across the country, and they would charge them a small fee to use their service. Now UPSALT has gone to a model where everything goes through its operations in New York. So there's a lot, and for a local legal services to affiliate with them is high cost. So there is some areas where there's concern that the attorneys who are now reviewing it are New York attorneys dealing with situations in Maine across the country. So I don't know how that has evolved, but you may So you may be seeing, I don't know if they've been in other areas. I think they have, because our information has come simply through our grantees who have told us of the changing nature of what's going on.
And I wanted to add something as it applies to preparers. I don't know if it's applicable in New England per se, but in Florida, among the Latino community, you have notarios, which are notaries. But in Latin countries, a notario could be an attorney. Mm. And so we had, when I practiced in Florida, the biggest issue we had were notarios taking on the role of preparing documents, bankruptcy, family law documents, and even immigration documents. And promising X, Y, and Z, and then ultimately the individuals being left high and dry. So I don't know if it's applicable here, but if you hear a Latino say, a notario filled this out for me, I would say that's a flag.
Well, Janet, what you're saying about the everything goes to New York, well, Judge Feeney would say, well, I've heard her say many times that how can you advising an exemption without practicing law, right? Mm-hmm. And so it seems to be that if you're in New York and you practice in a case in Massachusetts, how's that not?
I think that's, there are some people who have serious concerns about the revised EPSOL model.
Yes.
On the question, sorry. New York, do they still include the notice that there's an attorney?
I don't know. I don't know how they are implementing it. I would assume so, because their theory is the upsell model is theoretically designed for another way of providing access for folks who cannot afford an attorney. But I haven't followed beyond the initial request that came to us to find out how it has changed, because we basically concluded that was not a model. We did not support grants to that model.
Don? Yeah, I think I read not too long also the Ninth Circuit, I don't know what part, has some type of program like this that they're implementing to see if it will work to provide access.
What I am told is the courts have developed a system, and you're right, it's the Ninth Circuit, and they have a model for which and they're testing it there. Judge Maureen Tai is testing a model where it would allow individuals to come into the court and fill, as part of it is access to the computers, to fill out information on the computer, retain it for up to 30 days. But it's supposed to be the advantage of the upsolve idea was it was artificial intelligence. It was putting the schedules and statements into plain English. But again, you still have the same issue of, I believe the court's model is still for individuals who would not have an attorney. So I don't know if there are flags on that that would say this should go to it, you should really consult an attorney because this is more complex than the choices. But you're right, they are developing it that with the goal of being able to use it at bankruptcy courts across the country in place of, I know some courts have pro se clerks. That's the idea.
I know there's bankruptcy software. I know for a fact there's at least one that consumer bankruptcy filing software that I'm not going to say which has a function where you can send the debtor to a web page and it's in plain English. What stuff do you have? How much do you make? Like literally, and then how much have you made since February? For me, it says purposes. And they hit submit, goes right into the schedules like that. Mm-hmm. Attorney reviews it. It's still the attorney's case. It sounds tremendously useful. I've never used it, but at least on some level. Yeah. Let's go there first.
I practice in the District of New Jersey, and our court's website has an entire drop-down menu of how to file without an attorney, and gives you exemption information, and that's not standard across the country.
No.
And actually, I know because I served on the Lawyers Advisory Committee for the District of New Jersey about revising our Chapter 13 form to be in compliance with the national form, but we opted out. But to make it as user-friendly as possible pro se in 13, which is nuts, but...
Yeah, it's like 1% get a discharge or something crazy like that.
Right. But yeah, so I really thought that that was a national trend, and I'm looking at our bankruptcy court website right now, and there's...
Are you saying that which of the drop is that for 13s or 7s or
it's
both?
It's for both. Starts with bankruptcy basics, introduction to bankruptcy video, reporting out of personal bankruptcy, Chapter 7 debtor assistance.
Yeah, well, in Mass, and don't quote me on this, but I know that in Mass there was there was sort of a pushback because they didn't want to encourage 13 pro ses by doing it themselves.
Yeah, I agree.
But what I will say before we get to Sean is that in the materials, another plug for the materials, in the materials there are provisions that for most bankruptcy court websites there are there's a drop-down tab for those filing without an attorney. Mm-hmm. Second, I'm disclaiming Maine is a great place to do business. Sean?
I just obvious to me, but this is a
terrible idea to let people file their own bankruptcy without getting bankruptcy advice. Like, this isn't just a fact-based system. I don't just need to input facts. What are the implications of those facts? Am I going to lose my stuff? Things like, do I have claims that are going to be filed? Like, this is a bad thing. We should not be doing this. We should not be letting random people off the street who know nothing about this process and how to do it to file for bankruptcy on their own. I don't think that's something to...
What do you mean, random people? Wait, hold on.
No, let's not make a system that encourages it.
Well, they're not encouraging like petition preparers if that's what you're talking about.
Well, if you're telling someone how to like step by step just input.
But that's the person themselves, and they have a constitutional right to go into a courtroom and file.
No, I'm not saying they don't have a right to. I'm just saying like bankruptcy is not the most. It's not simplistic. There are things that can harm you,
but they're going to file to save the home. So you need to make the forms available, and then all you can do is have some sort of contact with a lawyer available. We have a clinic. It's free. You sign up online, you can sign up, and then you get advice from lawyers. The thing is, just telling you, you know, you don't have to pay the lawyer all up front in a 13. It's over time, and many of them will get lawyers. But there are people who will, they're going to file. They want to save that home, and to not make...
And they don't have the $4,000 to whatever it is.
I'm not saying take the home away from them, but maybe don't make it... Is there
anything else we want to discuss? Because we're actually, yo, Steve, let's.
I think Sean wants everyone to take this outside.
All right, let's. But, all right, everyone.
Before we go, and we have run out of time, I just wanted to encourage people who want to dive into ways in which to manage debtors' counsel fees, limited service agreements, bifurcation of fees. Those types of concepts are discussed in the materials. And I would encourage you, if you are considering employing any such technique, to read two cases, which are cited in the materials. One is Sear, which was a Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit decision that affirms the bankruptcy court is 515 BR 599. You'll see it's miscited in the materials. It's not 575. It's 515 BR 599. The far more interesting opinion in Sear is actually the bankruptcy court's decision, which is reported at 493 BR 158. And the other case that I would commend to you is In Re Hazlitt, which was decided just weeks ago in Utah. And there's a Westlaw site, 2019 Westlaw 1567751. That is correctly cited in the written materials. Sear had to do with a limited service agreement. Hazlitt had to do with the bifurcation of fees. They are both very well written opinions, all very well written opinions, very thoughtful, that take you through the applicable rules under the rules of bankruptcy procedure, the applicable sections of the code, but most importantly, the model rules of professional conduct that we talked about earlier on in the session, pulls that all together, and both Hazlitt and Sear are interesting stories to read. One where the attorney in Hazlitt did an absolutely remarkable job with the challenge of getting informed consent through very thorough disclosures and treating the whole transaction as if it were a truth in lending regulated transaction, and basically passed through the gauntlet that was laid for him under the ethical rules, and according to the judge, passed. Sear is the other side of the coin, where Sear was limiting his agreement to simply, well, he was excluding from the limit from the engagement letter any adversary proceedings filed against the debtor.
19-page fee agreement. It's a lot of
paperwork. He utilized a very extensive disclosure, a 19-page retainer agreement. The difference between the two was he was not in the room when the clients were asked to write and initial the 19 pages of the attorney agreement. But what was really interesting was that once the lawyer became involved in analyzing the case, the debtors brought to his attention the fact that there was a claim from a local hospital, $1 million claim. His response was, that's not a problem. Medical bills are dischargeable. What he failed to discern was that this wasn't a claim for medical bills. It was a claim for fraud alleged against the debtor in connection with the debtor's employment at that hospital. And following the filing of the case, there was the predictable objection to discharge. The attorney took the position that he had excluded that adversary proceeding from the limited services agreement, refused to represent the debtor, and quite justly, I think, was sanctioned for that conduct.
We're a little bit over, which means we did a good job. Thanks. Any final questions? Don, you got something?
Well, I just want to say on this bifurcation, there are companies now going into that, so their job is to provide funding so you can buy.
Absolutely.
And that's another layer. Yeah.
Another kind of from the journal. There have been two articles on this bifurcation, but what's interesting is both articles were written by the gentleman whose firm does the funding.
I get like a call every week from someone who's saying we can offer 0% zero down bankruptcy.
I know this is coming to debtors' lawyers.
Yeah. All right, everyone.
Thank you for your question.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.